Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. During the 1990s, the country, once known as Yugoslavia, was torn apart by militant ethnic nationalism. Some 250,000 people died. Over 3 million were displaced. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about this conflict and its aftermath with Robert Hayden. He is professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh. He has done extensive work on the reconstruction of states and nations in the former Yugoslavia, following extensive field work there. He'll be here on the campus of the University of Illinois later this month, specifically on the 21st of September, to serve as the keynote speaker for the 2007 annual conference of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center here at the University of Illinois. The topic for the conference, Building the Balkans Anew from Metaphor to Market. Let me tell you more about our guest. He's an anthropologist of law and politics. In addition to doing work in Yugoslavia, he's also done field work in India and also among the Senecas of New York State. He's also written on issues concerning the American legal system and its role in society. He holds appointment, in addition to that in anthropology, on the faculty of the law school there at University of Pittsburgh and the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. He also serves as director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at University of Pittsburgh. As we talk, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask, of course, is that people are brief, and we just ask that. So we can keep things moving along and get in as many different callers as possible. But, of course, listeners are welcome to join the conversation. That's easy to do. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. But if you're anywhere around Illinois, Indiana, in fact, if you're anywhere in the United States and you're listening online, you may use the toll-free line, and that's 800-222-9455. Professor Hayden, hello.
Hey, hello. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Oh, very well, David.
Good. Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it. You know, this isn't exactly ancient history, but it's a story that has been out of the headlines for some time now. Is it possible, just in brief, to recapitulate for anyone whose memories are vague now on what the Yugoslav conflict was really all about?
Oh, my. The Yugoslav conflict in 3 minutes, eh? Well, first let me say that I'm glad that it's been out of the headlines for a while. I mean, I used to do a lot of these interviews, and I'd much rather not be in a position of having people call me. It means that things are, you know, quiet over there and relatively stable, which is, in fact, pretty much true for the entire region. There are some exceptions, and I'm sure we will get to them. The Yugoslav conflict in a nutshell. Once upon a time, there was a Yugoslavia, a federal republic consisting of six republics, most of which were named after a particular nation, people, ethnic group in American terms. So there was a Croatia, and there were Croats. There was a Serbian, there were Serbs. Slovenia, there were Slovenes. Macedonia, there were Macedonians. Montenegro, there were Montenegrins. And the long story short is that it at the end of the 20th century, when the ideology of communism failed, and communism said that, look, a state is a set of structures that is there to advance the interests of the working class and all working people, and it belongs to them. When that failed, the default drive was not a liberal democracy, as Americans like to think of it, based on individual citizens. Instead, it was classic European thought, in which the state, which is a territory and a government, belongs to a particular nation, which is an ethnic group in American terms. And so what then you had was the secession of various Yugoslav republics in order to form states, sovereign states for that particular national, ethnic, in American terms, groups. So Slovenia for Slovenes, Croatia for Croats, Serbia for Serbs. It Serbs didn't secede. I can get to that later. And the only problem was that you had minorities, substantial minorities, in a number of these republics who didn't really like the idea of being the hated minority in a state that was basically devised to belong to somebody else. And this led to a number of conflicts in the places that were most mixed, that were least homogenous, particularly Croatia and Bosnia. Bosnia was the one republic in Yugoslavia. There was no single majority group. The largest group were the Bosniaks, or Muslims, 43%, followed by Serbs at 32%, and then Croats at 18%, and others. So you had then these wars to establish ethnic states, and that was what it was pretty much all about. And that is pretty much what has happened as well, that the territories are most mixed in the Balkans, and at least in that part of the Balkans, are no longer very mixed. It's pretty clear which group is supreme on which territory, whether it's on the level of a republic like Slovenia or Croatia or Serbia, or within Bosnia. I mean, the Republika Srpska, the Serbian part of it, is controlled by Serbs, and then within the other part of it, there are parts of it where Muslims, definitely Bosniaks, rule, and there are other parts, a few, where Croats definitely rule, and that's the way it worked out. I would like to correct one little item in your run-in. You said over 250,000 people were killed. Actually, that's not true. That's about twice as high as it turns out to be. It was probably about 125,000, 130,000 people, which is still a very great number of people. But the reason I mention it is that when the wars began, you had a propaganda war. This 200,000 figure came out almost immediately in 1992, and it actually made it harder to bring the conflicts under control, because then it became all sorts of moral issues, and we had stuff about genocide and the Holocaust and the like. Interestingly, there's been one genocide judicially found in the entire region, and that takes place in Bosnia at the very end of the war, not when all of the stuff was going on in 1992. So one has to be careful sometimes about the propaganda. There was almost a self-fulfilling prophecy aspect of this, inflating the casualty numbers early in the war made it much harder to resolve it diplomatically.
Mm-hmm. Well, given, I know that you've argued this, and having read this in things that you said years and years and years ago, that that what happened with Yugoslavia, the way that it came apart, the division into ethnic-based nation states, was something that's very consistent with 20th century European history. It's a kind of a process that we have seen before. So in that sense, perhaps we should not have been, would you go as far as to say we should not have been surprised that this happened the way that it did?
No, we shouldn't have been surprised in the least, and not just 20th century, but 19th century European history as well. But if you look at the 20th century, most of the places that were most ethnically or nationally mixed going into the 20th century are no longer so by the time you come out. If you think of Silesia, the region between that was, you know, shared by, divided by, between the Poles and the Germans, you know, that was very mixed going into World War II. It no longer is. Bohemia, what's now the Czech Republic, was a very mixed area, now no longer is. Some of the borderlands between Poland and Ukraine, between Poland and Lithuania. So you can look around the map of Central Europe and see the places that were heterogeneous are now, you know, quite homogeneous. And this was accomplished usually through pretty brutal processes of expulsion. Killing some to get the others to leave, the process we now call ethnic cleansing.
Hmm. Well, given the fact that that did happen, that there was bloodshed, I'm sure that you would not make the argument that the United States and Europe should have just stood by and not done anything. But having said that, then, if you look at what the European governments and the government of the United States did do, was it helpful? Could we, you know, should we have, you know, I suppose that this is with benefit of hindsight, but I would ask, could we have done something different? Should we have done something different?
Well, there's a big question as to who the we is. I mean, the Europeans and the Americans were working at counter principles very frequently throughout all of this. I mean, the original movement to get rid of Yugoslavia, to recognize seceding republics and to proclaim Yugoslavia to be dead, that was very much Central European. That was very much a German initiative that actually the United States originally opposed. However, when it became clear that actually nobody within Yugoslavia was interested in saving the entire country, I can get back to that, and that there were going to be these independent republics, and then the United States signed on. But then you had the interesting problem of what to do with Bosnia, and that was difficult because there was no single majority group. And if the model that has succeeded is that the state, which is a territory and a government, belongs to the nation, which is an ethnic group in American terms, that doesn't work if you don't have a pretty substantial majority nation that can more or less impose its will on the others. That you didn't have in Bosnia. You had about half the population, Serbs and Croats, making it perfectly clear that they were not going to consent to be in an independent Bosnia and Herzegovina. And thereby, therefore, recognizing it was going to be a disaster. But it was the United States that pushed for that recognition. The American ambassador to Yugoslavia at the time, the last American ambassador, Warren Zimmerman, recognized in an interview with the New York Times several years later that it was an error, that they, when they pushed recognition, they thought that if they recognized Bosnia, that that would prevent the Serbs and also the Croats from destroying it, and he said we were wrong. So once recognition of Bosnia came, you got a war from the Serbs and from the Croats to ensure not only that Bosnia would not be imposed upon them, but also that they would take parts of it that were otherwise shared with others, either with each other, with Serbs and Croats, or shared with Muslims. And so you got quite a bloody war about this. Unfortunately, after that, although there were a number of attempts to reach a diplomatic solution by the Europeans, they were systematically torpedoed by the United States. And none of us have ever been quite sure exactly why that was. I mean, some of it might have been a lack of understanding of the situation by an incoming, a brand new Bill Clinton administration in 1993, which really sank the first serious proposal to essentially divide Bosnia, to do what was eventually done in Bosnia in 1995, which was to recognize the territorial divisions, more or less. And that was sunk by the Clinton administration in early 93, and then another attempt at this was sunk by the Clinton administration. They always said that they were defending the interests of the people who were then called simply Muslims, or Slavic Muslims are now called Bosniaks, and it always turned out that at the end of the day, the next plan was even less advantageous to the Bosniaks, who wound up, you know, kind of the big losers in many ways in terms of where people were on the ground. Eventually, the United States did, you know, bring its weight behind an effort to be on the same page with the Europeans, and essentially gave in Bosnia the Serbs and Croats pretty much what they wanted, which was, although they had to stay within what was nominally a state, the government in Sarajevo had no authority of any kind by the Constitution adopted in Dayton to do anything at all within the territory. And so they could, you know, they accepted being within a state as long as the state was essentially make-believe and had no authority.
Hmm. I think remembering back to this and even reading some things that get written more recently about what happened here, it's the thing that I remember is people voicing this concern that if this conflict somehow wasn't contained, that it would break out of the borders of the former Yugoslavia, draw in surrounding countries. Pretty soon, Europe gets involved, then the United States, Russia, and pretty soon what you've got is World War III. And that the important thing here was, no matter what else happened, that the conflict be contained. What was there ever that kind of danger of the expansion of the conflict, and did this policy of containment actually, was it somehow counterproductive?
It's hard to say where an expansion would have come. An expansion might have come over a competition over Macedonia, but Macedonia wasn't really threatened at that time. So it's kind of hard to say where you would have gotten an expansion. Who would have had the interest? I mean, who would have tried to move troops in or out or the like? Now, you did have a great deal of political and geopolitical posturing going on at the time. Bosnia became a major cause in the Islamic world, so that you had Malaysians who had no idea where Bosnia was on a map but were signing up to fight in Bosnia. I mean, you had a great deal of interest from the Muslim world in North Africa, from the Arab world, from the Iranians, so that it became a major cause. And in the Americans wanting to show that, you know, we are not anti-Muslim, I mean, one of the lines that Condoleezza Rice continues to use in regard to Kosovo is that, you see, we have nothing against Muslims. We supported Muslims in Bosnia. We support Muslims in Kosovo. And so there was that level of geopolitics going on. By the way, one of the reasons, though, I kept hearing in Washington from people in a position to know that America supported the Bosniaks, the Bosnian Muslims in Bosnia, insisted on there being a Bosnia that had also Serbs and Croats, was the intent was that there not be a purely Muslim state which could then become an Islamic state. And the intent was that the Serbs and the Croats between them would control the Bosnian Muslims, which is, you know, your typical cynical geopolitics. There was also a geopolitical angle to it. Certainly the expansion of NATO to include the entire Balkans region and to make the Adriatic and, for that matter, the Mediterranean a NATO lake. I mean, that was certainly a post-Cold War continuation. You found by the end of the decade that Russia had been shut out of the Balkans for the first time in 300 years. And that was certainly not an unintended consequence of NATO actions, and particularly of American actions. There's also a formation of a certain amount of and related to that, a certain amount of American military capacity, some NATO capacity, but it's mainly American, in the Adriatic and in places like Kosovo. There's a very major base, Camp Bondsteel. Nobody's quite sure what it does. It's not defending Albanians from Serbs or Serbs from Albanians, but it's a very big base. So what does it do? We're not quite sure. It did serve briefly as a kind of European Guantanamo, a kind of no man's land where, you know, black flights could go in and out. So there are all sorts of these things going on. But it was never likely to go into World War III. Certainly not. But there were all sorts of geopolitical games that did focus on it.
Well, that just, I wonder, you know, we think of this as being probably the first major conflict of the post-Cold War era. At the same time, I wonder whether this, and there were some ways in which this conflict, or perhaps the ways in which Europe and Russia and the United States involved themselves, that would say that this was actually an extension of the Cold War.
I think if you were to put that question to many Russian analysts, I think they would view it as very much an extension of the Cold War. That they wound up, you know, with NATO expanding directly to their borders, NATO expanding in an area in the Balkans, you know, excluding the Russians from the Balkans completely. So I think they would view that very much as an extension of the Cold War. There were also points at which you know, American military supremacy in Europe. There were brief moments in which the Europeans started talking about forming a European Defense Corps, and then the Americans were very against that because it would seem to be a counter to NATO, and NATO is very much an American-run show. So that those things were in fact going on, and the Russians certainly view it that way. So that now when you know, we hear from the Bush administration that the Russians are returning to the Cold War rhetoric. The Russians are saying, well, you know, we may be returning to it, but you guys actually never left it. So
let me introduce again our guest for this part of the show, and then we have a caller we get right to. We're talking with Robert Hayden. He's professor of anthropology, law, and public and international affairs at the University of Pittsburgh, where he is also director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies. He is an anthropologist of law and politics. He's done extensive work on the reconstruction of states and nations in the former Yugoslavia, and he will be giving the keynote address at an upcoming event. This is the 2007 annual conference of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center here at the U of I. This will be not next week, week after that, I guess. He'll be giving his talk on Friday, the 21st of September, 4 in the afternoon, at the Auditorium of the Library and Information Science Building on East Daniel. And there also will be a number of other talks associated with the conference. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here we have a couple of callers here. First one is in Fisher, I believe. That's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm astounded and appalled that you can talk for 25 minutes in your analysis and not mention the fact that essentially what was occurring in Serbia and Bosnia was that Serbia, under Milosevic, was waging a war of ethnic cleansing. 90% of those 135,000 people, victims, were Bosnian Muslims. I mean, this was genocide in Europe, never again, right? I mean, do you disagree with that?
Sure, can I? Yeah, I can disagree with it on a number of grounds. One of them is... So I'm sorry, should I?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Yeah,
well, in the first place, you know, the entire image is wrong. You have this image of, you know, the Serbian army invading Bosnia. What you had instead was the Bosnian Serbs were constituted as an army with a great deal of help from Serbia. But the Bosnian Serb army was exactly that. It was a Bosnian Serb army, and these were Bosnian Serbs who were not going to have a Bosnia and Herzegovina imposed upon them. Now, at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, they did engage in a campaign of taking territory that they wanted, either that they shared with Croats and Muslims, or that even if they didn't share it, if it was strategic. So they did that. In terms of the casualties, you're actually wrong about the figure. The total casualty figures, and what I'm going to give you, I can cite and cite academically, but they actually stem from the prosecution of the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague and the cases against the Serbs, and also from a study done, a very careful study done in Sarajevo with support from the Bosnian government in the last couple of years. And your casualty counts in Bosnia in the entire period of the war is 102,000, and that's a pretty firm figure. It's been done very, very well using a cross-referencing a great many records. And I would note that, you know, as recently as the 10th anniversary of Dayton, American diplomats were still spouting 300,000, 90% of them Bosnian Muslims. Of your 102,000, about a little over 50% were, in fact, Bosnian Muslims. No, actually, it's a little over 60% were, in fact, Bosnian Muslims. Then the second largest category were Bosnian Serbs, followed by Bosnian Croats. In terms of the breakdown between military and civilian, unusually for a war in the 20th century, in which usually the casualties are far greater among civilians than among military, the casualty breakdown in this war was about 50-50. It was about 50% civilian casualties, 50% military casualties, with the provision that among the Serbs, the greatest number of casualties among the Bosnian Serbs killed were actually military, not civilian.
In fact, what you're saying is like flies in the face of a number of things that are rather authoritative about this and the figures and what happened. Essentially what happened, of course, was the Serbs unleashed a military force against a largely civilian population that was unarmed, i.e. the Muslims. You recollect like 10,000 deaths in Sarajevo?
Yeah, you have 10,000 deaths in Sarajevo over a period of a siege of over 1,000 days, yes. Yeah,
you
have 10,000 deaths in Sarajevo.
I'm astounded. I don't understand how you can have academic credentials and maintain these things.
Well, you know what? I just told you I could source my stuff.
Well, yeah, I heard your sources, and I don't believe your sources.
You don't believe in the prosecution of the International Criminal Tribunal in The Hague,
yeah,
and you don't believe
that's what they said. 90% is what Carlos Del Ponte said.
No, it's not. Or if it is, she's not reading the stuff from her own stuff. I mean, you can find this stuff on the web.
And you don't believe the ethnic cleansing occurred? I went through Bosnia.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that at all. I said that ethnic cleansing absolutely did occur. No, that's a different question.
You don't think the authors of it?
I'm sorry?
You don't think the Serbs were the prime authors of that?
I think the Serbs did the most of it this round, followed by the Croats, followed by the Muslims. And then in 1941 to 45, it was the Croats, followed by the Serbs, followed by the Muslims. But it's also, as we were saying earlier, a type of situation that has been relatively common in Europe. But if you want to talk about the academic stuff, you know, I can do that from now till the end of time. But, you know, I was following
you're a minority
this stuff
position,
in...
Right?
I'm sorry?
No, you're a minority position.
I'm sorry?
You're in a minority position.
Oh, yeah, but that doesn't mean it's a wrong position. I mean, Galileo was in a minority position.
Oh. I'm going to jump in here because obviously the two of you are not going to see eye to eye, and I have another caller I want to get to. Let me, though, ask a fundamental question here. You're not arguing that the Serbs here were guiltless. What it sounds to me like you're arguing is that there is a lot of guilt to be shared around. Do you think, in fact, that in the way that the West has talked about this, the way that the Western media has reported this, that we have put too much emphasis on violence committed by Serbs and have not recognized to the correctly violence committed by other parties in this conflict?
Yeah, I mean, look, no question that the majority of the casualties were inflicted by Serbs. There's no question about that in this particular round. By the way, if you go back to 1941 to 1945, then that's much greater casualties, and the great majority of those are Serbs and inflicted by Croats and Muslims. But, you know, we don't need to go back to that type of living history because it's not ancient. The Serbs, Serbian forces, did a great deal of violent and evil stuff here. Unfortunately, it's been treated as if, in the first place, Serbs were the only ones who did this. But in the second place, it's been treated as if it were a very simple situation in which, you know, the Serbs, Milosevic, invaded Bosnia, which simply isn't so. You had a population, Bosnian Serbs, you know, the descendants of people who've been living there for many, many, many generations, who did not consent to be included in an independent Bosnia and Herzegovina and fought to prevent that, as did the Croats. And then they both mounted very offensive campaigns to take additional territory. But that's a very different situation, and it's also one that's much harder to handle. As you may have noticed, it's very difficult to impose an effective government in an area in which much of the population rejects it. And of course, it's ironic to me now that we're having people like the former American ambassador to Croatia, Peter Galbraith, proposing that Iraq be partitioned. And yet the situation in Iraq is in some ways very similar to that which obtained in Bosnia.
Hmm. Well, let's go. We have another caller here. Let's go to them. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I had a question about an argument that Professor Hayden puts forward in his excellent book, Blueprints for the House Divided. He basically, Professor Hayden, you put a lot of blame on the Slovenians for starting the so-called constitutional crisis of the summer of 1989. And while I agree with that, couldn't you argue that this was a response to a very, very aggressive leadership by the then new leadership of Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia, who came to power in 1987. So what other means of responding to Milosevic did the Slovenes have that would not have destroyed the Federation? And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks for the plug for the book. You can get it at your latest bookseller, but it may put you to sleep. I've got to go slightly into the constitutional history, and I'm sorry about that, but it's the only way to answer the question.
Sure.
The Yugoslav Federation was a federation. There was a central government. There was also a complete government in each of the federal units, each republic, as in the states of the United States. In the late 1980s, there was a movement for state supremacy that actually originated in Slovenia, and it was very much like that in South Carolina in the United States in the 1830s. The principle was that this may be a federation, but federal law has no effect in Slovenia unless we, the Slovenes, consent to it each time. You can't run a federation like this. I mean, this was John C. Calhoun's doctrine. Strangely, they didn't cite Calhoun. But so the Slovenes were effectively seceding, destroying the federal structure, because you can't have a federal structure without a federal supremacy clause, destroying the federal structure of Yugoslavia. But the problem was that once you destroyed the federal structure, a federal structure provides mechanisms for the peaceful resolution of conflicts between federal entities, between states in the United States, for example, or between the republics in Yugoslavia. Once that federal structure was destroyed, there was no longer a way to resolve conflicts between the federal units, between the republics. Now, the caller is absolutely right that the Slovenes did this in response, at least in part in response, to a very aggressive policy by Slobodan Milosevic, who had just become president of Serbia and was trying to be the new Tito, was trying to take over all of Yugoslavia. And the Slovenes, quite understandably, resisted that. But the interesting thing about it to me was that they just chose to resist it by destroying the Yugoslav Federation. Now, I talked to some of those guys at the time. They were very well aware that that would mean a war in Croatia and Bosnia. And they didn't care because they judged, and very accurately, that they would come out of it without much of a war. And that they would be recognized quickly and that they would proceed rapidly to the European Union, which in fact they did. So it was a very rational calculation on their part, but it was also a very rational calculation to bring about a war in the rest of the country. And then the interesting question is, okay, what else could they have done? Well, it was still within the Yugoslav communist system. It's hard to believe that they couldn't have at least tried to work with the leaderships of the other republics to get rid of Milosevic, but there's actually no evidence that they ever tried to do that.
Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Certainly, an awful lot has been said about Slobodan Milosevic and his being implicated in ethnic cleansing in Bosnia-Herzegovina and also in Kosovo. It's also the case that people would say that the government of Croatia and the leader of Croatia, Franjo Tudjman, also engaged in ethnic cleansing in this region called the Krajina, where there was a significant part of Croatia where there was a significant Serb minority. And this happened much earlier in this conflict. No one seems to talk about that. Why is it that there wasn't more? And they're both gone now, so you know, maybe it was had something to do with Tudjman never lived long enough to be brought up on charges of crimes against humanity. But why was it that it seemed that no one ever really seemed to make much of what Croatia did to Croatian people who were Croatians but who were ethnically Serbs earlier on in this conflict?
Well, actually, there are some cases in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague against Croatian military figures for precisely this, and some Croatian political figures in Bosnia, where Croat forces engaged in the same types of activity. So it's not that it has not been responded to. It was not noted as early on. When the war began. In 1991, there were efforts, but the Serbs would take territory in Croatia, take control of territory, and ethnically cleanse Croats. The Croats were taking control of territory in some parts of Croatia as well, and ethnically cleansing Serbs, of which there were large numbers. So these things were going on, but part of Tudjman had put forth an image of himself as a Democrat. Of course, he had been elected. Well, Milosevic had been elected, but Tudjman kept saying that he was, you know, following Western values, and he really courted the United States. He really courted Germany. He really courted other West European countries. And Milosevic, apart from being arrogant, Milosevic is one of the worst strategists of the 20th century, if not all time. He was at times a brilliant tactician, but as a strategist, he chose to rely on the Soviet Union in 1991. Well, the Soviet Union was gone within a year and a half. So Milosevic made the Serb. Milosevic never tried to fight a propaganda campaign, and the Croats and the others did. But certainly the image of you know a Serbian aggressive army. I mean, there were units of the Yugoslav army that did definitely move into Croatia, and they said they were moving into Croatia to support Serbs who were threatened by the Croatian government, which was actually, in fact, true that they were threatened by the Croatian government. But the ways that they chose to respond to this was by taking control of territory and ethnically cleansing Croats from it. So you had, Tudjman and Milosevic understood each other extremely well and thought in many of the same ways and dealt with each other very, very well. But the Croats were in the position, and quite literally being able to say that they were simply defending their internationally recognized territory, which was true, that they then did it by expelling the minority population. Well, that was regarded as unfortunate, but by the time the largest expulsion came in 1995, it was pretty much regarded as, well, that's unfortunate, but that's just... that's just what has to be. In fact, Holbrook says in his book somewhere that when one of his underlings was, you know, saying we should say something to President Tudjman, and the response was, these guys are our junkyard dogs.
We have about 12, 13 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd like to introduce again the guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or even 10 minutes. We're talking with Robert Hayden. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh, where he also holds appointments on the faculty of the law school and in the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. He's also director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. He is an anthropologist of law and politics. He's done a lot of work on the reconstruction of states and nations in the former Yugoslavia after extensive field work there. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You said at the beginning of the program that in one sense it was good that Yugoslavia or the former Yugoslavia hadn't been in the news much because it meant that things were relatively stable and quiet there, with some exceptions. Where are the exceptions?
Well, the current exception is Kosovo. And it's still quiet there, but that's a potential problem. Another potential problem is Macedonia. But you know, the original point, I'd much rather be able to talk about just the tennis players than to talk about the conflicts. But I mean, Kosovo and Macedonia, Bosnia can kind of struggle along. I mean, Bosnia has been divided. There's still no sign whatsoever that the majority of Serbs or the majority of Croats who are left, and there actually aren't many. One of the parts of the Bosnian story is that probably half of the Croats living in Bosnia in 1992 have left, so that the percentage of the population who are Croat is probably under 10%. It was 17. Kosovo, I suppose, is the major issue now. Of course, what was happening in Kosovo, Kosovo is a part, still officially, legally, a part of Serbia. It was the heart of the medieval Serbian kingdom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's also an area that, you know, Serbia, there hadn't been an independent Serbian state under the Ottoman Empire, and then the Ottomans controlled it. It became increasingly Albanian, became part of Serbia after World War I. Part of the new Yugoslavia, the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, later Yugoslavia, but it was probably never majority Serbian in the 20th century. It became less and less Serbian throughout the course of the 20th century, and particularly in the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s. Well, then you get into a situation in which, you know, the local majority population, who were the Albanians, is a minority at the larger level. There were demands by the Albanians for autonomy. This was resisted by Serbia on a number of grounds, not least of which is that, you know, that autonomy leads to secession. And so you get into a type of sad situation that you've seen in other parts of the world and in other parts of Europe in the 20th century, in which the larger state is trying to control a territory in which the majority population of that territory, minority in the state as a rule, doesn't want to be controlled. Think of England. Think of Ireland. You know, up until 1923. You know, think of Ireland from 1916 to 1923. You can think of a number of other places in the world, and this is not a pleasant scenario. I mean, think of Israel controlling the West Bank directly when they were administering the West Bank directly before they withdrew, and of course what they're doing now is another set of issues. It's something that can never be pretty and can only be brutal. I mean, it's not that it can't be pretty, it can only be brutal. And so, you know, Serbs were controlling Kosovo militarily. Police rule, and it was quite brutal. Now, that type of thing can go on for a long time. Eventually, it does reach a kind of resolution. You know, as you saw when the British finally left Ireland, the Israelis pulled back from the West Bank, and the Indonesians have left, blanking on the territory. But in any event, but that was kind of the last territory in which you still had them resolved. You had a almost the last territory in the former Yugoslavia in which the majority at the level of the republic didn't have full control over its own territory. The United States, for various reasons, decided to back the Albanians in Kosovo, and did this from early on. Rather interestingly, Strobe Talbot, who was then Deputy Secretary of State, his chief of staff published a book a couple of years ago in which he said that, you know, really we kept talking about human rights, but it was really it was intolerable to have a socialist still in power. And so we were really concerned with the geopolitical structures, which kind of goes back to the post-Cold War elements of this. This is a guy named Norris, a book called Collision Course, NATO, Russia, and Kosovo. The United States put pressure on Serbia, and but also supported the Kosovo Liberation Army. Most of the Kosovo Albanian politicians throughout the 1990s were trying to avoid catastrophe. They wanted to have an independent Kosovo, but they did not want to have a war. And they worked very hard to prevent this. They were very, very good people. They were undercut by the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was a bunch of guys that said, hey, look, you're not delivering independence, and so we'll take up arms. And those guys got arms. They got arms from the United States. They got support from the United States. So the United States, you know, helped the Kosovo Liberation Army attack Serbs. And this led, when Serbs responded, Milosevic, as I said, was a lousy strategist and not a good tactician as well. See, you can have this type of situation go on for a long time, but Milosevic finally responded to American threats. The Americans, as of late 98, were threatening to bomb Serbia. And Milosevic told them, look, as soon as you start bombing, we're going to start ethnically cleansing. He didn't use the term, but he said, we're going to start driving the Albanians out of Kosovo. And the Americans called, you know, called the bluff. And if you look at the figures, even the American Association for the Advancement of Science Studies all indicate that, you know, the targeted but brutal repression that Serbian forces were utilizing until the bombing started on March 24th, 99, became a campaign to drive Albanians out of much of Kosovo. And it did, and they did. Which was criminal. It was also stupid because as hundreds of thousands of refugees were driven out of Kosovo, the Italians and the French and the Germans knew that they had to get them back in Kosovo within a few months or they were going to start showing up in Italy, France, and Germany. And so you had this war. It was a grand miscalculation on everybody's part. The Clinton administration seriously seems to have thought that Milosevic would capitulate within 5 days, which nobody in military or civilian intelligence thought, by the way, but the, you know, they kind of went forward with the war against the advice of their advisors. Where have we heard this before? Who said it wasn't going to play out that way? And Milosevic miscalculated as well.
Let's talk with someone else in Champaign County here on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Please forgive me if you've covered this before, but could you explain to me why the Europeans did so little to stop this ethnic cleansing that was going on in the Yugoslav republics? Thank you.
Well, the Europeans did not want they wanted people from Yugoslavia to stay anywhere but in the European Union. They did not want to have Serbs, Croats, Muslims, Albanians in Germany, France, Italy, and so they wanted to get those people back into Bosnia, into Croatia, into Kosovo. So they really wanted to get the war settled. And when it was settled, they were sending people back in large numbers. That actually caused some resentment in Bosnia because people who stayed for the entire period of the war, fought the war, lived extraordinarily badly, were wounded, lost family members and the like, and had nothing. I mean, all of a sudden there were tens of thousands of returnees from Germany who were given money by the Germans. And, of course, they'd sat the war out in Munich or wherever they were. And we're coming back with money, and that caused a certain amount of resentment in Bosnia itself. If I can go back to if I can go back to Kosovo, since we're going to be running out of time, and that is now the major issue. Mm-hmm. It's clear that Kosovo has been ruled by the UN under NATO control since the end of the bombing in 1999. And it's clear that the Albanians will never consent to live under the sovereignty of Belgrade. It simply will never agree to it. And why would they? They were, in fact, attacked. But it's also clear that the remaining Serbs in Kosovo will never consent to live under the sovereignty of Albanians. And again, why would they? Because the Albanian, the Kosovo Liberation Army, and most of the other Albanian parties, not all, have made it clear that there's no future for Serbs in Kosovo. The natural solution to this is to divide the territory. There are still parts of Kosovo that have a majority Serbs in them and that have almost no Albanians. And the rest of it has almost all Albanians and almost nobody else. So the natural solution to this would be to divide the territory, to partition it. We keep hearing resistance to this, just as we heard resistance to the idea of partitioning Bosnia in 1992, 1993, that it would, quote, open Pandora's box. I keep seeing that. Well, they opened Pandora's box when they so quickly wrote off the continued existence of Yugoslavia, which was a multinational, multi-ethnic, in American terms, federation. And if you're not, if you're going to be pious enough to not open Pandora's box, you have to recognize the consequence of that is that if borders don't move, populations will be moved. I mean, if all of Kosovo is recognized, there will be another couple of hundred thousand new refugees, Serbs this time. And Serbia has the largest refugee population in Europe already, who would see and see very correctly that they have no future in Kosovo.
We're coming down to the point where we have maybe 3 or 4 minutes left. I wanted to have you talk at least just a little bit about the subject that you will be talking about when you give the talk here in 10 days or so, and that is about the possibility for building connections, at least, between peoples that have been torn apart by this conflict, or at least, you know, between states that now have this these ethnically consistent populations. Is to what extent is that possible, and is that something that, again, outside parties, Europeans or the United States, can help with?
You know, it's definitely going on. I mean, even during the Yugoslav wars, the strange thing is connections in many ways are never broken. During the war between Serbia and Croatia, there were 6 regularly scheduled buses a day from Belgrade to Zagreb. Neither one of them went all the way. They both went to a truck stop in southern Hungary and switched passengers. But you could do it. So connections between peoples were there. And with the ending of the wars, actually a lot of trade and other types of interactions have been booming. And you can normally drive between Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia, so, I mean, the whole formerly Yugoslav space, plus, you know, the rest of the Balkans, Bulgaria, Macedonia, Greece. Albania is harder because it doesn't have a very good road system. But what's fascinating is there's not much infrastructure. It's easier to fly from one Balkan capital to Paris or Munich or Frankfurt or London than it is to another Balkan capital. If you want to fly, quite often you have to go, you know, via Vienna or via Frankfurt or something. The road network is curiously underdeveloped as well. There are very few highways connecting the countries. The highway networks are entirely internal, entirely internal. So it's not hard. There are plans to extend them to the various borders, and that actually needs to be done. I think that now that the region has been largely reorganized, like most of the rest of Europe, along the standard nation-state principles, you know, there's no reason why you wouldn't be getting the development of trade in other contexts. And in fact, you are. Not just trade. The largest music festival in Europe now is every summer in northern Serbia in Vojvodina, and you got people streaming in from Croatia, Bosnia, Slovenia, as well as from the rest of Europe. You've got, you know, people from Serbia going to the Croatian coast and that type of thing. So those are all taking place, but there's still a lack of physical infrastructure to do it, not so much within the former Yugoslavia as within the rest of the region. And that all needs to be upgraded.
Well, it seems that you're making this interesting point that says that maybe instead of insisting that people see eye to eye politically, maybe that's not as important as it is at least making it physically possible for people to have contact with one another, and that maybe then either the other stuff will work itself out, or maybe that's even not as important as we might think.
It may not be as important as we think. I mean, you know, look, if you look at the aftermath of the American Civil War, You know, when the South wasn't building memorials at Gettysburg until the 100th anniversary of the battle, and I could still hear, you know, comments against the Yankees, you know, through the 1980s. My good friend and colleague here in Balkan Studies, who always, he was from Florida, he was a native Floridian. I referred to the Civil War. He referred to the War of Northern Aggression. You know, how long does it take for some of these things to work out? If you go to Mexico, you know, our great triumph in 1847, there's a big statue in Mexico City to the heroes of 1847, you know, who were resisting the American invasion. You don't actually need to get agreement on history. And in fact, in some of these types of historical incidents, you will never get it. But you don't actually need it, because that's the way, you know, states interact, peoples interact, once you establish a certain type of political and economic stability. The political stability has largely been established in the region. The economic stability needs to be established. And for this, you need the development, more of the development of agriculture. Infrastructure, not its big agricultural region, but of infrastructure, linking the region to itself, the parts of the region to other parts of the region, it just is, instead of being primarily oriented towards Western Europe.
Well, I think at this point, about this point, we're going to have to finish up with, again, the mention that our guest, he's Robert Hayden, he's professor of anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh, will be in Champaign-Urbana on the 21st of September to give the keynote address at the 2007 annual conference of the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center here at the U of I, Building the Balkans Anew from Metaphor to Market. That's the topic for the conference. He'll be giving his talk 4 in the afternoon in the auditorium of the Library and Information Science Building on the U of I campus on East Daniel. In addition to being professor of anthropology there at Pittsburgh, he is also on the faculty of the law school in the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs. He's also director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies. And Professor Hayden, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.